Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the January 19th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swain, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Monson right here. He's an author, a political commentator, an economist, let's say, because that's true. And he's also the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Monson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. I am so glad to be with you, even though we are looking at each other yet again on a computer screen.
3,000 miles away. And I haven't told you, next week I will be in Baja California recording the podcast, if that's okay. We'll be doing it from a distance again.
I don't mind at all you going to Baja. I think that's great.
I've been invited by a guy who's, all I know is his first name is Gavin.
How are you going to get there with the wall that Trump had built?
I'm remarkable on the monkey bars since age.
You know
what's
amazing though? Like, I know the people that listen to us that don't like us bringing up the Trump stuff, but I also know that some of them are the people that told me back in 16, they're like, look, Dave, which is always when someone's about to say the most patronizing thing possible. Like, hey, you got to understand that I'm about to say something really important. And then how many people said, you are probably right that he's got this problem and that problem, but you have to admit, I mean, the one thing we know he's going to do, he's going to build that wall.
He's going to build that wall. And that's going to stop people from flying in airplanes.
And by the way, I don't care at all that he didn't build it. I don't care that like Mexico didn't pay for it, because I never thought any of that was possible. And my views on immigration are way too nuanced for Twitter. But I am totally mystified. I guess you got to say Ann Coulter is an exception. I was about to say how all the 2016, really, really enthusiastic Trump folks let him off the hook on this, but that's not actually true, because Ann Coulter was as Trumpy as it gets, and then she has vehemently churned on him. And so some did not give him an excuse, but when you're in Baja, will you take some pictures of how much of the wall has been built? I'm just curious what the update is there.
Keep in mind, I'll be at the very bottom of the peninsula down near Cabo in a tiny town.
Oh, well, then you're not going to see any of the wall.
No, I'm not.
Let me put it this way. If you were going to Tijuana or Cabo, right, you would see the same amount of wall.
I wish I'd said that. That was good. Hey, there is so much. The first run list I was going to send to you had 26. Send to you, I had 26 items. I have narrowed that down just a wee bit, and I want to start with Kamala Harris. A great piece by Molly Hemingway. I've never had the pleasure of reading Molly Hemingway. I did not, and I don't know for a fact that she's always this funny and nuanced. But this is a great piece. The headline is, no, Jeffrey Toobin, Biden is not putting Kamala Harris on the Supreme Court. And whenever you mention Jeffrey Toobin now, you have to insert a joke. She does. Here it is right in the lead.
You can skip the joke.
It's a great joke. CNN legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin took a break from punishing his colleagues by toggling his joystick at work on a Zoom call to opine on who he thinks President Joe Biden might nominate to the Supreme Court in the event Associate Justice Stephen Breyer steps down at the end of the term. Cut to the most important feature here, and that is Toobin is suggesting that, among other people, a Californian, in fact, Leandra Kruger, that maybe VP Kamala Harris should be nominated to the Supreme Court. And Molly offers innumerable ways, some of them just kind of like political statesmanship and just kind of like political negotiating inside the Senate, all the way to she's incompetent. Did you have a chance to take a look at her argument there, David?
I did.
I was most impressed by the fact that in a tied up Senate, of course, the VP is supposed to break the tie. This would almost certainly be tied up in the Senate, 50-50. And she would then be called upon to vote on her own nomination to the Supreme Court, which seems not likely to pass legal muster, but I'm not a court executive, so what do I know? So there's that problem. And also, if she moves into the Senate, until Biden can pass a VP replacement by through the Congress, because it's not just a I get to name my own guy, whomever it is. It has to be approved again in the Congress. There's still a 50-50 tie with no way to break it. So there's no replacement for Joe Biden.
All right. Can I help Molly out with something?
Please.
Her analysis of this whole thing is excellent, and the political odds, and, you know, Tubin throwing it out there. And I recall, by the way, certain people on the right saying the same thing about Ted Cruz possibly getting nominated. The number one reason is not because she won't get through. It's because she has absolutely no interest in being a Supreme Court justice. She wants to be jet setting, rich and famous. She has no interest in doing scholarly, jurisprudential analysis of anything. This is a prima donna, not someone who wants the actual judicial, intellectually strenuous work of being a judge.
You might be describing Sotomayor, of course.
Well, no, here's the thing. I think Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Elena Kagan are diametrically opposed to everything I believe in. And I think that they still view their role on the court as being a justice. I disagree with their process. I disagree with their judicial philosophy. Kamala Harris doesn't have a judicial philosophy. I don't believe for a second that would remotely like, you know, how someone could have like a middle manager job. Mm-hmm. At like a big company.
Sure.
And then they can come to you and say like, hey, so such and such opened up. And then there's always that job and someone's like, yeah, no, you know, I'm kind of waiting for this. So that doesn't appeal to me. I think it's like that. It's sort of like she's a middle manager in accounting and they tell her a middle manager job at marketing opened up. And she's like, yeah, no, I'm waiting for the CEO. And I'm not saying CEO like president. I'm more saying something with more sex appeal. And my view of Kamala is that she is just totally disinterested in anything that takes hard work. And I felt that way back in California and in her DA work and so forth. She is willing to do the work of climbing. And I'm not referring to anything having to do with Willie Horton's furniture or anything. I'm saying climbing the political ladder.
Yes.
And I don't think that the Supreme Court, Molly's completely right, Will. Of course she can't get through a 50 votes. And I think she'd have some left-wing problems, too, on some of the criminalization of pot stuff that happened in California. Yes. Same things that plagued her in the Democratic primary. But I'm just saying from a career aspiration standpoint, Ted Cruz would view being a Supreme Court justice as a step down from what he wants to do with his life. But at least Ted Cruz would be tempted by the fact that he does care about what he could do on the court. I have no doubt in my mind. Kamala Harris couldn't care less about that. She couldn't care less.
Ah, it's so sad. Okay, one last line from Molly's piece, because it just sort of affirms the underlying theme of our conversations about Kamala. If it wasn't so obvious to everyone before 2020, it is certainly difficult to hide now the fact that Harris is not the most incandescent bulb in the intellectual chandelier. Her performance in the Kavanaugh trial did receive accolades from some sycophantic media fans, but was completely unbecoming. But she dismisses that issue very quickly. Just that, you know, look, it's not even that she's incompetent, it's that it won't work. You cannot get her through the Senate. And I like your idea that she's just uninterested. All right. Next headline story here was.
And by the way, Will, I say the same thing about Michelle Obama with the presidency. That's how much rock and roll that gal's got going, that the presidency is like, nah, come on. You know, why would I do that? Because she's just living it up. She's clubbing with Jay-Z and everybody. So imagine like your life where you were a community organizer in Chicago and now you laugh at the idea of like being president. Like, come
step
on.
Down. Yeah. Yeah. Not going to be trapped by that job.
Yeah.
There was a big exchange in other news between carried out primarily by Semaphore flags, signals, flares. Ron DeSantis presented his new budget, and and seems to have launched a pretty aggressive attack on Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom fired back in the media and without really naming names, both of them trying to be like, you know, my good friend, the gentleman from Florida or whatever, just sort of indicating they were talking about the other. And Newsom tries to make the claim that, in fact, California is far better off than Florida. And the and at one point he told reporters that there would be 40,000 more dead Californians if he had done here what DeSantis did in Florida. So the COVID numbers are pretty clear. California did marginally better than Florida in terms of actual COVID deaths. But as Guy Benson points out in a piece on Town Hall, you know, governors inherit the population, the demographic sensitivities that their populations have. And Florida is a much older community. And of course, COVID primarily pounded on people who were older. But the big trade-off that Guy points out, which you and I have pointed out endlessly when we talk together, is that Florida was much more wide open, that its economy boomed. And Guy points out, others have pointed out, that there's an important health metric, a public health metric tied to things like liberty, the ability to run your business unencumbered, the possibility of going back to school. And these are all things on which DeSantis inarguably did far better than Newsom has done. But here's the quote for Newsom, if you'd like to think about it. It says, I always love the fact that Newsom has this phrase that he loves to deploy when he's trying to be nuanced and, what's the word, gentlemanly. With respect, we'd have 40,000 more Californians dead if we took his approach. Speaking of DeSantis, I do not look for inspiration to that particular governor, to not only the pandemic, but to other policy, that's a sick, including the absurdity that was his woke initiative and the laughability around stopping something that doesn't exist around critical race theory. So his second thing is to say that DeSantis has tried to gin up far-right wing crazies at school board meetings by talking about the fact that critical theory is being taught in our schools. And Newsom is trying to suggest it doesn't. This is the applause line for the far left. There's no such thing as critical theory being taught in K-12. That's an academic discourse at the undergraduate, perhaps graduate levels and scholarly circles. And yet you and I both know, and we'll come back to this later in the show, critical race theory doesn't necessarily announce itself as CRT. It comes through in many guises. It is any kind of racist curriculum designed to offer assessments of people's individual privilege based on race, gender, et cetera. And so, as I say, that's not nothing. And gaslighting the California public by continually telling us there's no CRT, there's no ethnic studies curriculum in California that emphasizes these kinds of divisions is simply dishonest. And DeSantis did a good job of going after that, of keeping schools open. California's unemployment levels are higher than Florida's. Our taxes are higher. Our population has declined. Florida's have not. So you can only point to the problem of governance in both these instances. It's a problem of dysfunctional governance. But I think the key point here for us is that many observers, and I love your assessment on this because I'm included in that that group that believes Newsom and DeSantis are kind of trying to lay out the landscape for 2024. DeSantis may be angling for a run at the presidency again. There's a lot of buzz around whether he will or he won't because whatever Trump is thinking about. But Newsom clearly has his eyeball on that and clearly sees a DeSantis opponent in the presidential general election as a problem for him, I think. Thoughts, horse race thoughts on this, David?
Well, no, you're exactly right. And I think it's probably a pretty smart move by Gavin. He's showing himself to be a little bit smarter of a political operator than I always think him to be, because it's completely disingenuous and factually absurd. And yet I think Newsom is doing the cynical thing of probably rightly believing that the nuances and the sort of necessary adjustments on data would not necessarily be made by voters. The idea of looking at absolute levels on COVID without adjusting to policy is like, in my business, looking at a portfolio performance without adjusting for risk. It's absurd, you know, it's apples and oranges. And I think that this is actually part and parcel of the entire problem with COVID policy, is the ignoring of trade-offs. And so if they ignored trade-offs in making policy, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that they ignored trade-offs in evaluating policy. But the scoreboard on this will be abundantly clear for people who are fact sensitive. And Ron DeSantis performed incredibly well. And you also, I would argue, have to adjust for vulnerability of population. The senior citizen population of Florida relative to California is another huge factor. So not only do you have density, aging, vulnerability, and then economic adjustment. You know, it's why people say like, oh, Sweden ended up with a certain amount of death similar to other places. And I go, yeah, well, France's GDP, it was down 14% and Sweden's was down 6%, you know, whatever the exact numbers are. I don't have them handy. I knew it more a year ago, but that's the way you have to view this. So you're right on the facts, but I suspect Gavin has a political angle here. And they're both going to try to beat at that. But what Gavin has to do is not worry about Ron DeSantis right now or worry about Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or whoever is going to end up being in the 2024 presidential conversation. What Gavin Newsom has to worry about is how he's going to tell his voters that a white male is an acceptable candidate for president. Because we've been told over and over again by them that it's not. And I know we have a white male as president now, but that white male said he had to pick an African-American female and he picked one who was clearly a liability to his candidacy. And the only reason he did it was for the identity politics reasons. And I want to know not how Gavin beats Ron DeSantis, because I'll take that on any day. I want to know how Gavin deals with the wokey woke in his own party. Now maybe they all can sit down at French Laundry, and just you know, open up a bottle, and start to discuss this thing with a little class and some caviar, because so that's what
Speaking of the fallout from COVID lockdowns and pandemic policies here in California, my own colleague Brandon Ristoff did a really interesting analysis. I may have mentioned this briefly in a previous episode, but he looked at data from OpenTable. Yeah, probably everybody knows what OpenTable is. It's a little app you use to go and reserve a table at a restaurant. And what he finds is that if you look at this data from OpenTable, it shows that mandates have resulted in LA and San Francisco restaurants losing nearly a quarter and almost a half of their customers. That is a quarter in LA, almost half in San Francisco, while restaurants in cities without such measures have returned to or even surpassed pre-pandemic numbers. It's a really solid analysis. Including, for those who love that sort of thing, spreadsheets showing which cities and which months did well. So I really recommend people looking at that. But his point is, and I think this, you know, this ties in with our conversation about Ron DeSantis in Florida versus Newsom in California, it's that these total lockdowns with the promise that we were going to eliminate COVID, we're going to kill it, flatten the curve, whatever, has turned out to be bogus. Newsom recently, of course, we talked about this, extended his emergency authority into this year, knowing that Omicron was going to boost COVID cases, if not necessarily hospitalizations. But this, you know, this is business. These are the small business owners out here in California who were told they could not open their restaurants, even though a bar could, or they couldn't open their restaurants, but a weed dispensary could, or a strip club could, but not a church. So you've got this business sector that has just been pounded. And we all remember what this was like. You would see a restaurant open for a few days and they were super enthusiastic to welcome you back. And like 3 days later, there was some new kind of county metric that tipped them back into closure. So we've got that. And then you've got the one of the most fascinating stories here. And David, I don't believe I put this in your run list, but here's a story from, because it's from the Chronicle. Coronavirus devastated San Francisco retail. Now the city is imposing a new landlord vacancy tax. So first you get lockdowns, which shut down a business and reduce or increase commercial vacancy rates, right? Because these businesses all closed. So they got all the space available. Now the city's stepping in and saying, we can't have closed retail or commercial space. You're going to have to pay a tax, an additional tax, a surcharge on unoccupied commercial space. So this straight out of San Francisco. First, we punish you with a lockdown, and then we blame you for the causes of high vacancy rates. And then the whole school closure issue, which is still exploding and still has parents pouring into city, school board meetings and county boards of education and demanding the schools be open, confronting fairly frequently the panickers who want everything shut down. And then we're starting to see this kind of rolling blackout or something, if you want to call it that, for public schools. Oakland announces a wellness day off. So everybody's so stressed out by COVID, including teachers, that they're going to give two students and teachers days off, because in Oakland, at least, the teachers union there was planning a sick out. So rather than force them to go on a sick out, which will give that district a black eye, tick off parents, they just tried to sort of wave a wand over it and declare it a wellness day. So that's what we now call school closures. And David, you sent me a great piece on school closures, revealing progressivism for what they are. This one was in the New York Magazine's Intelligencer. Do you want to talk about that? And just sort of, here's the headline for you. School closures were a catastrophic error. Progressives still haven't reckoned with it. And this is, gosh, who is this from? I'm so sorry, I don't have a byline here. I lost that when I copied it. In any case, school closures, progressivism, we've talked a lot about this.
Yeah, well, Jonathan Chait's a well-known author, very left-wing. He's a good writer. I've enjoyed reading him over the years. I disagree with him a lot. But I just want to point out, Will, that David Leonhardt of New York Times, I think he just moved from the New York Times to Washington Post very recently. And there's a couple writers at The Atlantic. This is an issue that has forced people on the right to admit, wow, that lefty writer at that lefty publication has been pretty good on this issue. Now, too little, too late, sure, okay. Where was this in the fall of 2020? Totally fair. My point is, this article is outstanding. And it comes at a time where I'm just surprised that that they have been willing to admit that they were wrong. And that they, what they're implying is not, okay, now's the time to take the mask off. What they're basically saying is, geez, it turns out this thing hasn't done anything.
And this is, you're right, this is a real trend in on the left, where you've got guys like, totally blanking on him all of a sudden. This is so embarrassing. Ezra Klein, we talked about a week or two ago. You know, Ezra Klein famously writes that California is embarrassing the rest of progressive America because we are so deeply flawed, including on our pandemic responses. You and I featured a few of these writers in the past. There's Michael Schellenberger, the, you know, now famous former progressive, who said, like, holy cow, these progressive policies are destroying low-income communities. So on this COVID issue, you really do see a huge number of progressives kind of getting more awake than ever. There's a great piece I'll put in the show notes also by Dan McLaughlin, National Review, School Closures Reveal Progressivism for What It Is. Just, you know, worth a quick read. Also, that Intelligencer piece by Jonathan Chait. Let me ask you, David, if are one of the stories I am seeing, and I'm not the COVID expert that you are or have been, and I wonder, you know, Omicron is spreading rapidly through the community. It's more highly contagious, less lethal, of course. And yet I still see the drumbeat in the mainstream press in California. Here's one from the LA Times. California schools under intense strain, fighting to stay open during Omicron surge. One of the things they point out is, a lot of this is about panic, but they just sort of like reference that people are concerned about this, and that it probably isn't as severe as people are making it out to be. But you end up with that panic, closing classrooms, teachers trying to figure out how to adjust lesson plans. I'm reading from the story, with fewer than a third of their students at their desks, absenteeism high among students and employees. But really, there's a kind of a quality of just panic that has taken over. And I wonder, do you see anything in the data that suggests that the panic is legit?
Oh, I not only don't see the data, I don't see the panic. So I have different inputs right now. What I see is almost universal acceptance from people I don't like that I will never forgive for how they handled COVID 2020-21, waving a white flag and admitting we have to learn to live with it, admitting without ever saying the words that Trump was right, admitting Trump was right, admitting it's endemic, admitting that most mitigation efforts are futile with this type of infectiousness, admitting that we have to get our lives back, admitting masks don't work. Now, there are exceptions, as we've talked about, with unions and the Chicago thing and with other teachers that this select group of teachers I refer to as proven that the surest fire way to get someone to act like a non-hero is to say that they're a hero, because these teachers have just beclowned themselves. But yeah, I know you're right that there are some out there. I know the media has done their best for clickbait, but by and large, I do believe that there is an implicit, okay, I'd like it to be explicit. I'd like the President of the United States, who, as we're sitting here recording, you might see the TV behind me, is literally giving one of his first press conferences since 1983. But I'd like the president to come out and say, hey, look, guys, we got to learn to live with it. Get your masks off. Get your kids in school. Those of you that are vaxxed, you're going to have way less lethality risk. Those of you that aren't, you made your decision. You know, go to, you know, vax.com if you want more info. We'd love to talk you out of it. But at this point, I don't give up anymore. Yeah. We're going back to life. I'd love the president to say it. Well, he's not going to say that. But I think everyone's acting like that. So the panic side of it, it's already turned today, by the way, the 7-day average of both cases and deaths has declined. They were predicting a January 30th peak. Today's January 18th or 19th as we're recording, 19th. You have UK has already seen substantial drop in both cases and severity. They're reopening completely. They're lifting all restrictions. South Africa's back to pre-Thanksgiving levels. So Omicron was a bad cold for unvaxxed. It was a mild cold for some vaxxed. It didn't really matter if you were vaxxed or not as far as getting it. And other than that, Omicron was the booster we needed. And I believe that we're maybe 6 weeks away from every man, woman, and child admitting that people like you and me have been right all along. But I'm telling you, as a Christian man, it's hard for me to say what I'm about to say, but there are people I'm not going to forgive. I will not forgive them for what they've done in this period.
Well, you and I have called it, or at least I have. I won't tag you with this one, but there is a kind of public health terrorism out there.
Yes, there is.
These people who just love to generate the fear and then point to the fact that people aren't showing up in schools as evidence that people are afraid. It's insane. Okay, so
by the way, when you say I'm a COVID expert and you don't know as much as I do, I just like to point out I have terrible COVID bona fides. No one on earth has worked harder than I have to get COVID. And I've been completely unable to do it. And I have traveled 67 times on an airplane. I've gone to foreign countries. I have walked all over New York City, thousands of miles. I have gone and spoken in front of 1,000 people. I haven't worn a mask in over a year, other than when someone put a gun to my head and said I had to. And I can't get the damn thing. So what kind of COVID expert am I?
You're not very good at catching it, that's for sure. So Dan McLaughlin writing, I don't know why we got the blessing of Dan McLaughlin writing about a story like this. Here's his headline: U-Haul literally ran out of trucks leaving California. So everything we've talked about, Gavin Newsom, Ron DeSantis, various COVID lockdowns and economic metrics. Here's, you know, this is always one of the places where the rubber literally meets the road. When you measure the outflow of California population, we saw that California's population declined over the course of the pandemic. Florida's increased. If Florida was so bad, why were people moving there in huge numbers, apparently? So Dan writes, he looks at the U-Haul annual review of interstate moves in 2021. Texas and Florida, the big inbound winners. California bled, this is from Dan, California, however, bled outbound citizens so badly it broke U-Haul's ability to measure because the company ran out of trucks to rent. We talk about this frequently. We've had a few listeners who've written in and said they don't understand why this is a metric. And if you don't, I'm sorry, but it just seems like such an obvious way to measure the impact of the pandemic and the lockdown and just other kind of contextual problems here in California with the cost of living, the rising tax rates. We talked last week about the fact that there's now this single payer government takeover of medicine in California. It is a government takeover of the health industry in which every healthcare employee from doctors and surgeons at the top down to the admin people in the back office are going to be minutely told how to work, how much they can charge, how they price things, what they can do, what they can't do. And the cost of doing that is going to double the budget. It's just a shocking to me that they would do this. But as you pointed out, I think last week, David, unlikely that that'll come before to come to a real vote or that the governor would allow it to come to a vote before the June primary and certainly before the November election when he has to actually run on taxes that are going to be doubled. I don't think so. So I want to talk about one of the more interesting stories that popped up this week, an opinion piece that appeared. I saw it first in San Francisco Chronicle. It's appeared now in USA Today as well. An opinion piece by a guy named Joe Matthews, who's a former LA Times reporter, lives in Pasadena. And you and I have talked about his columns before. He's a fairly funny guy and typically comes down on our side on issues, though he presents as a liberal. But his headline is, if you want true equity, California should force parents to give away their children. Now, lots of people I saw on the internet are going crazy and thinking this is a serious proposal, but there's all kinds of evidence deeply embedded in the story that he's just yanking our chain. He's doing our heads in. What he's actually saying here, he actually uses the phrase modest proposal. I have a modest proposal, which is a kind of a nod, a genuflection to Jonathan Swift's modest proposal. For those who don't know about it, look it up. Jonathan Swift, a modest proposal. He suggests that the way to end the 19th century famine in Ireland would be to actually have all Irish eat their babies or sell their babies to the English to be eaten. That would reduce the surplus population and at the same time cure hunger. Of course, he's joking. But there's a lot in here that's really worth just, you know, sort of laughing about. I'll put it in the show notes. But I think, you know, again, he says at the beginning that this is a proposal. It's very modest. And then at the end, he says his proposal will birth a brave new world if we just allow the state to take over the parenting of all children. His argument against his proposal, I think, is also very conservative. He says anybody who opposes my proposal would really need to sort of understand that parents are the place for absolute differences and bias and privilege, that it's parents who bequeath to their kids a legacy, either for better or for worse. And if we could just divorce children and raise them in common, we could avoid this this inheritance of privilege. And he says, you know, anybody who thinks that the family is a great place is really not noticing that our differences and bias, they're claiming that our differences and our biases inside our families, for all the damage they can do, also give human life. These families do much of its meaning. So he's really, you know, he is defending the family by offering this kind of crazy, outlandish proposal. He tries to have it as both sides are bad on the family issue. But to me, this is a broadside against progressivism and the argument that somehow conservatives are also occasionally impulsively anti-family. His examples there are dumb, I think. So it doesn't really land. He accuses conservatives, for example, of endorsing family separation at the border among illegal immigrants. No.
It's not dumb. He's wrong. But like, if you're trying to get a point that like, oh, conservatives aren't really that pro-family either, and lefties aren't pro-family, and he uses left examples. If I wanted to state that conservatives are hypocritical on family, the border separation issue would be what I'd go to. It happens to be untrue, but I think it's still making the point he's trying to make, as long as you're willing to not to go with a narrative instead of facts.
Well, and he also says, though, that anti-abortion is really an anti-family thing. And I just
Well, yeah, that one might be a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah, we're not telling you that we're going to take over your kids. We're just trying to stop you from killing them. That's all. Okay, so a quick late break.
I just want to say on the thing about him being serious or not serious, you and I texted. It must have been very early for you, by the way, because it was like 7:30 for me in New York, and you were writing back. So were you pulling an all-nighter or were you up early?
I was just up early. I was pulling a Bonson.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I was up late for a Bonson. I was up at 4:30.
I wonder if the conclusion, I'm with you as I was in the beginning of our text thread. I don't think it's serious, but I don't think it's a full Onion or Babylon Bee thing either. What I wonder is if it's one of those sorry, not sorry things where like people say the words and it's meant to like indicate an apology, but then they gave you just enough to kind of say like, yeah, well, I'm not really sorry, but like, no, I'm sorry. Like, I wonder if it's tongue in cheek now, but in 20 years, it'll be more serious from progressives.
Oh, I think it absolutely is. We saw this in places. Now, I have some friends who live on the kibbutzim. Those are the collective communities on the Al-Sabin collectivist communities in Israel, set up primarily by European socialists who wanted to create a new social order. And the friends I have who grew up in these kibbutzim say, look, man, you know, we were taken from our families at a fairly early age and put in a kind of a dormitory. And, you know, from my perspective as a kid who grew up in South Orange County in a very nuclear Catholic family, it's not like you're being raised by wolves. But the idea was exactly this progressive impulse. So we've seen this experiment before. We saw the Soviet Union try to step in and really kind of change the way in which children were reared. Because they needed to create the ultimate communist man or woman. So I do believe this is the progressivist impulse. And we saw this even in California. I've talked about this at too much length already, but you know, our early head of the superintendent of public instruction, a guy named Jonathan Swett, famously said, parents have absolutely no role in educating their kids. That's our job. You can do it at home. You can do your thing. But over here, you don't talk to us. And more than a century later, we're having the same conversation. We're literally being told. We saw, what's his name? I'm sorry, Youngkin, new mayor, first name. Kevin, Keith? I don't know.
Glenn.
That's a K name. So Youngkin makes his...
Glenn Youngkin. Say Glenn.
Glenn Youngkin. Thank you. Youngkin. Makes his inauguration speech. I don't have this in the show notes either.
As we call him in my house, President Youngkin. But go
President
ahead.
Youngkin. You know, a guy who was swept in large part, I think, swept into the governor's mansion in Virginia by parental outrage over ham-fisted school officials basically telling, and Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate for governor, saying the parents really have no role here. We saw the FBI called in by no less than Merrick Garland and the Secretary of Education, you know, calling the FBI in to stop parents from talking at school board meetings and threatening people. Again, an act of public terrorism against parents who are simply trying to just make sure that their kids are educated well. And while Youngkin is saying that parents have an absolute choice, they have an absolute responsibility to oversee their kids' education. You could see in video of the event that while Youngkin's making this declaration, which shouldn't be controversial, the Democrats are sitting silently and not applauding while the Republicans cheer. We're now the conservatives are now the one group standing up for people of all political persuasions, ethnic groups, races, and classes to say that parents do have an important role. And it's the progressives pushing us toward this kind of brave new world in which the state runs our kids because the family is filled with privilege.
Well, I mean, you're preaching the choir, my friend.
Yeah, yes. Hey, Pete Buttigieg came out while you and I were recording last week.
No. He had come out years ago. He was in. He came out of the closet, I think. that was a long time ago, Will. So you must have missed that.
I missed the news. Pete Buttigieg flew to California in order to tout the supply chain achievements and efficiencies at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach.
Did he fly on a solar powered plane?
I'm sure he flew out powered by the smugness of his own sense of responsibility for having saved Christmas, which is what L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti introduced him. You know, this is the man who saved Christmas, the transportation secretary in the Biden
Did
White
he really?
House.
I didn't see that. That's just ridiculous.
Yes.
Dear
Garcetti called Buttigieg the man who saved Christmas while introducing the secretary on Tuesday. The problem with this is, of course, that the supply chain is not fixed. The wife and I were hanging out in the wife and I were hanging out in Long Beach on Monday and driving along Ocean Boulevard, where these beautiful homes look over a, you know, palm tree lined kind of median between their homes and Ocean Boulevard and the beach. Just a beautiful area. And you can see the tankers just lined up. I'm sorry, the cargo ships just lined up forever out there still. And we know that they're stalling them out farther out at sea now, of course, so that we can't see them as much. But this doesn't change the fact they're still stacked up, still lined up. And here's the thing that really, really infuriated me. Not the Christmas line, but Buttigieg's claim that we are making up for decades of past disinvestment. We're going to see impacts on shipping times and shipping costs, but we are making up for decades of past disinvestment. We've invested so much in these ports, and this was partly to pitch the infrastructure bill that passed and partly to kind of pitch people getting rallying for the Build Back Better initiative that stalled in the Congress. But the idea that there's been disinvestment is complete BS. What's really gone on, as listeners know, listeners of this show know, is that we've watched as the governments of the city governments of LA and of Long Beach have created a relationship with the sorts of union workers in the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, have blocked technology. We would still be having mules pulling wooden carts out of Long Beach if it were left to the ILWU. They do not want any mechanization, any automation that will eliminate worker jobs at the port. And that's the disinvestment, if you will. It's making sure that these jobs are protected against any kind of automation. But if you read Buttigieg, it's that we've just failed to invest in our ports and that just requires more taxpayer dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm worldly enough to understand that politicians just have to lie and spin things all the time. And I also don't want to, you know, be so outraged that it sounds like I'm ignoring the fact that the Republicans are capable of doing it too, either, you know, twisting facts, taking too much credit, shifting blame in ways that are kind of ridiculous, but help fit into a political narrative. This one, though, does bother me because I don't think that you could find like a six-year-old who could take this seriously. The notion that what has caused our supply chain problems right now is an effort to oversimplify something that's more complicated. And because I have not bought in to the anti-intellectualism of the day, I don't like that as a trend. I think serious people should approach serious issues with a tone of sobriety and complexity that it warrants, and the supply chain stuff is complicated. So when I hear like someone on Fox News say, "Oh, we have supply chain problems because we gave everything to China," you know, I condemn that too because it's a stupid comment. There's issues related to China that are very relevant, but this thing about, well, we have supply chain issues because we underinvested in infrastructure, it's just flat out nonsense. If you had the most state-of-the-art system ever invented and none of the workers show up for work, or you shut down on weekends, or you only work 8-hour shifts, or you're doing mandatory COVID testing every 6 minutes or whatever is going on, I don't care when the system was built. So what Pete's doing is lying to the American people about a complex problem. I don't like it when my side does it, and I don't like it when their side does it.
Did you follow the big story about these kind of, I'll call them smash and grab too, groups of people boarding trains in L.A., really close to downtown, in downtown, just boarding these trains that are carrying massive numbers of packages for like UPS and Amazon, and just absolutely hijacking this cargo, just tearing it to shreds, opening the boxes right there on the sides, you know, on the rail right of way for Union Pacific as it goes in and out of L.A. And a lot of our listeners have probably seen the story, But the thieving has been so severe. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of packages every day just going missing. And, you know, people in plain sight, at night under cover of darkness, going into these areas and opening up the cargo containers and then just ransacking them for everything. And then leaving so much garbage on the side of the road that a train derailed. Now, I'm not 100% sure the derail was completely related to this, but it's hard for an amateur to look at the mess that has become of this rail bed and not assume that that played some role in it, because there was literally garbage piled up. Now, I talked to a Union Pacific executive a couple of years ago who told me that, in fact, as they tried to remove homeless people who were endangering not just the trains, but themselves by living, camping out near these train tracks. This person said they were told by local officials all over Southern California and by the state that they couldn't move these people. They had to house them. And the Union Pacific official told me this very straightforwardly. And I said, wait a minute. What do you guys know about housing people? And the woman said, well, there's the rub, isn't it? We're not really in the housing business or the mental illness business or, you know, that kind of a cleanup. But she was talking about an undescribable filth surrounding these homeless encampments near rails and being told that they couldn't do anything to clean it up. And they have problems with guns and drugs, and you can imagine the human waste around there. But this problem with these thieves just wilding near rail cargo, is also made more problematic by the fact that as people are caught in LA, of course, we've got the DA over here, George Gascon, saying like these are misdemeanor crimes and therefore these people are booked if they're booked at all on a misdemeanor and then released immediately on their own cognizance because we don't have bail anymore. So these people, instead of doing any time in jail, really being processed through the criminal justice system, are simply returned to the streets and then go back out. There's some evidence these are the same people coming back night after night. Even when arrested, they are being released. So Union Pacific actually sent a note to George Gascon saying, please, you've got to stop the madness. They say, in October 2021 alone, the increase in crime, that is, was 356% over a year before. Union Pacific has not been contacted for any court proceedings. Union Pacific, this is from a note to the DA. Union Pacific urges LA County District Attorney George Gascon to reconsider his Special Directive 20-07, which specifies 13 specific misdemeanor charges that will be dismissed with certain exceptions. While criminals are being caught and arrested, charges are reduced to a misdemeanor or petty offense, and the person is back on the streets in less than 24 hours after paying a nominal fine. In fact, criminals boast to our Union Pacific's officers, there is no consequence. So you see, again, the ways in which the supply chain here is clearly now in chaos. And this is not China. This is not COVID. This is a political dysfunction. Again, getting back to the issue of governance that distinguishes California from Florida. And we've got a county DA elected to an office who declares immediately, I'm just going to minimize all criminal charges against people because of social justice concerns.
Yeah, I mean, the whole entire law and order thing, the issue, what I like about this, because you and I know we have a lot of listeners outside the state, I really think it's important for people outside California to hear this, because there's things that just, I don't believe other people around the country believe us. That if they were to hear it, they just wouldn't believe it. It's so outside levels of logic, levels of common sense, and the you're getting exactly the consequences you would expect to get. Law and order issues have generally been good bridge builders for independents and moderates, and this is one that the left is doing themselves no favors with.
And what do we say? A conservative is a liberal who's been mugged.
Mugged by reality.
Thank you.
Irving Kristol, one of the
is that who
great,
that was?
Irving Kristol. Yeah.
Wow.
Irving Kristol, the conservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. Irving himself being a former a radical liberal and progressive who became one of the great intellectual forefathers of modern conservatism and someone to whom I am extremely indebted.
Oh, thanks for that tip, man. I have a couple more stories that are very important to get to, and I want to do that in a minute, but I really do want to pause and say, I have my own reasons for being optimistic, nevertheless, about the direction of California. And I always, I hesitate when I put these run lists together, because I really do fear, as some listeners have said, that we're just beating up on California. It's hopeless. You know, what's the hope out there? And I think there is actual hope. You just kind of touched on it. This fact that when things get really nasty, then people grow up. They become so wide awake, they can't unsee what they're seeing. And that's why you get recalls of San Francisco the Board of Education. It's why you get a recall of Chase Aboudin up there, and a recall campaign forming around George Gascon. You and I are in agreement that recalls are probably misguided. Live with this stuff. But on the other hand, you see lots of people acting in ways that are inconsistent with their own espoused progressive and liberal ideology. They're starting to come around on things. And I think, as you say, this catastrophe begins to hit people in a place that is so close to home. Somebody else just said, I read this somewhere just recently, that we're all conservative in the things we know best. And when it comes, for example, to having to pay more for your groceries because of supply chain inefficiencies, and you can't just blame COVID, you find out the government is actually involved in creating this catastrophe, you begin to think differently, because you are an expert in your own home budget. When people tell you that you have no role in your kid's education, you're the expert in your kid. So do you have, like, when you look at all this kind of river Styx of hellish stuff flowing by your eyeballs every day, what is it that gives you hope in California?
Well, let me give a holistic answer. Okay. I'm more on the pessimistic side, but then I'm going to give some caveats that reflect what I truly believe. And it transcends my belief about California. It's what I believe about an awful lot of things on this side of glory. I think that the state is mostly irreparable, and that sounds like hopelessness, but I sit around, first of all, I do a podcast with you about it, but as you know, I do plenty of other things in my time and treasure as well. So I must not really believe it's irreparable, but what I do believe is that I don't know what the path is. And I do know that any political consultant who tells you is wrong, and you should run. Because I'm firmly convinced that what is ultimately wrong in California is much more than political. So I do think there's a lot on my side that understandably want to believe, if we could flip an election, if we could recall this guy, if we could pass this measure. And I think even a lot of the friends that I have within California Policy Center that you work for and I serve on the board of, and that you admirably lead. I think there's a lot of people that believe if we defund unions, we would win. I believe that's a tactic, but I don't think it's an assurance. Ultimately, California is more ungovernable and more down the path of irrepair than even other deep blue states. Other blue states have shocked us: Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Delaware, Maryland have red governors at times, or one of their two senators goes red, or different things. California has not flirted with that kind of, like, maybe every now and then we can get a little purple going on for a very, I mean, it's been really since the 96 election cycle. You're talking about a long time. It's gone by now, about 25 years. So then people say, well, let's defund unions and let's pass school choice and let's use law and order issues. I want to do all of those things. But I just don't think that we as conservatives do ourselves favors by not understanding that we do not have a governor problem. We have a governing problem. The people of some of our mass cities are ungovernable and they are unprincipled. And there is a character issue that I believe will take the divine intervention of God to fix. Now, that makes me a wackadoo spiritually or something. I don't really care. I mean, think about the things I get called compared to that, right? That's not going to get me. But I think this does require prayer. and serious prayer, because we need to go do all the things we can do. And all of the things I've talked about, I'm for doing: union reform, school choice, those issues. But at the end of the day, the Bay Area problem, the radicalism that's embedded into the ethos of the state, the control of the unions, these things are not something that were forced upon us. We took it, and we took it good and hard. Okay, to paraphrase Chesterton. Oh, no, it was Mencken, wasn't it? That was Mencken.
I think we've had this conversation. I think we decided it was Mencken.
Yeah. And so if I sound right now like an optimist or a pessimist, I don't know how it necessarily sounds. I'm totally optimistic about the American experiment. I'm totally optimistic about our endeavors on this side of glory. I hold to an eschatological view, for those who care about such things, that is what is called postmillennial. I'm deeply optimistic about what will happen here on earth. But when someone narrows it down to California and then talks as if California is just an election away, and if we could flip this governor, I think they keep us from making progress, because they don't recognize the first step to fixing a problem is admitting you have one. We've Yes. heard this before. The folks who want reform and change in California have got to come to terms with the fact that we did not get this problem because of Jerry Brown or Gavin Newsom, that the people wanted this sort of dysfunction. They voted for it over and over again. They got to a point of moral, cultural, and political deterioration that has allowed the state to this point. And the rebuilding out of this ditch is going to be brutal. And so that's my view. And in the meantime, I intend to devote my time and treasure to helping fight the good fight. And sometimes I think the fight is much more at Pacifica Christian High School, or at California Policy Center, or at National Review, or even just at a local church gathering, than I think it is with swaying a particular election. That's my view and experience, Will.
Well, there's the famous saying, of course, that politics is downstream from culture. But what is culture except the aggregation of individual spiritualities and or, I'll call them, psychologies, for our friends who are secular? It is the formation. It is the values of the individuals in that culture that determine the policies. And yeah, let me make this really quick, because I know you got to run. I got to run. But there are three stories I want to get to. I'll just tell you the top line. You give me your response. Activision Blizzard. We've talked about the fact that they had some internal problems. They've just announced the sale. It looks like I think it's still pending, but Microsoft has offered $75 billion to acquire the company. What I want to ask you, David, is, it seems to me very clear, this is almost like a short sale in a sense. You know, you had somebody out there. Now, listen to it this way, though. I have seen stories about short sales in which somebody was determined to drive down the value of the stock by demeaning that stock. And here we had the state of California and others, but primarily the state of California, beating up on Activision in a very public way. Talking about internal distress, a non-diverse workplace, a workplace that was hostile to women. And so you had the government pressing, and then you get the Wall Street Journal, of all places, doing an expose saying how horrible it is inside this organization, how incompetent it is. And all of a sudden, Microsoft steps in. It's short isn't the right word, but it's almost like a determined effort to drive down the public value of this company and then allow somebody like Microsoft to come in and acquire it for a lot of money. It's the largest acquisition, I guess, in Microsoft history. You're wincing as I misuse terms. So talk me out of this.
The valuation is ridiculous of what Microsoft is offering. And so it isn't like they've come in and bought it on the cheap. They're paying 24 times earnings for a company that has flat earnings over the last 5 years. And so is Activision more open to a sale because of the current problems? I think that's about right. But, you know, the stock was at $46 at the beginning of 2019. It's at $80 now, $82. And if this deal was believed by the market to be going through, the stock would be trading higher. Microsoft has offered more than this right now is a $64 billion market cap, and Microsoft's offered what equates to 75. Now there's $6 billion of net cash. So really, Microsoft would be buying $6 billion of cash. So it equates to a $69 billion cost to Microsoft to pay 75 for a company that right now, even after the announcement of the deal, has a $64 billion market cap. Why does the market not believe the deal is going through? Because of regulatory headwinds. There's always what we call merger arbitrage, where people place bets against the deal getting done. Look, the stock was down from the midpoint of 2020 to the lower point you refer to, but I don't think it's because of the rumors getting out there and bidding it down. I think it's because the stock was at an astronomical price in the midst of COVID, and then that kind of work from home, play from home, playing around video game thing wore off. It's a highly cyclical company. They need new IP. That's why the earnings have kind of flatlined. They'll have a year of $7 billion of earnings and a year of $4 billion and go up and down. And I'm not a gamer, and I really can't stand any of this stuff. But my understanding is that, like, Call of Duty can only come out every couple of years or whatever. They can't just continue to have a new hit video game every year. So I'm not trying to correct you or anything. I'm just saying I might have a little different view as to what's behind this. I'm far, just from an investment standpoint, far more critical of Microsoft's role in this than Activision, because I think it's an egregious use of Microsoft capital. They're paying all cash for the deal. They're taking half of Microsoft's cash on their balance sheet to go buy a video game company at an absolutely astronomical valuation.
So you'd be more persuaded by my argument that there's something rotten in the state of California here, if in fact Microsoft was able to pick this up at a discount and they're not.
Yeah, I don't think it's a discount. And I think that you're right in your premise. You're right in your conclusion, but I wouldn't agree with the premises that are getting you to a conclusion.
Got it.
But you know what's fun about you, Will, and me together in this podcast? We value premises and conclusions. We value the cogency of thought that carries premises to conclusions. And when someone gets a conclusion right accidentally, then we want to unpack that, where other people are just like, hey, sounds good. Let's do this. Yeah,
got it. Hey, second to the last.
Are you mad at me about this?
No. Are you kidding? I'm grateful for your insight. I did not know what, you know, in all the stories I read, I did not see that they were paying well above value. So
let's make a commitment, though, to having a fight in 2022 on air, because we've agreed so much for so long. I'd like us to just get after it.
Okay, let's get after it on this one. I'll make it really fast. California businesses expected to pay higher taxes to make up for unemployment shortfall. So the Employment Development Division that lost nearly $31 billion to fraudsters in sending out COVID relief and unemployment benefits now is turning to Sacramento. Well, they're in Sacramento. They're turning to the governor and the legislature to raise taxes on individuals and business to pay their way out of the deep hole they've got themselves in. They borrowed billions of dollars from the feds to pay unemployment benefits. David, at a time when U-Haul can't even get enough trucks online for people to get the hell out of here, you've got the state threatening to raise taxes for a takeover of the medical industry and also to make up for the loss in EDD for unemployment.
Yeah, this sounds like the type of people that we need to have set up a state bank. What are some of the other issues on the healthcare? They want to kind of be the first to go to a full single payer. So, you know, this competency of the state sounds like someone that deserves greater assets in their portfolio.
Last story, pardon me, California settles lawsuit with parents, removes Aztec chants and prayers from ethnic studies curriculum. I said earlier that this is from the Center Square, by the way. I said earlier that the governor was trying to troll Ron DeSantis by saying that Ron DeSantis is wrong. There's no critical theory in schools. Frequent listeners to the show will recall that among other things in the new ethnic studies curriculum put out by the state was the use of Aztec prayers. I tweeted out, California unions, eat your heart out, because a judge has decided that the Aztec prayer, probably a step too far for the state curriculum, but the ethnic studies curriculum wanted to include an Aztec prayer. It's called Inlach Ech affirmation, which repeatedly invokes, makes intercessory requests, and give thanks to Aztec deities by name in order to relax students. Talk about no separation of church and state. David.
I think you know exactly what I'm going to say.
Inlach Ech. Yeah. Hey, before you go, I just want to say that I've got an interview coming right up with a friend of mine named Zach Whiting at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And I'll introduce the whole thing here in just a moment when Sarah rolls the tape. But the bottom line is, I think you're going to love this, David. This is a guy who's been hired to do tech policy, a new area for Texas Public Policy Foundation, our sister organization at CPC. These are our friends in Texas who do there what we do here. And they've hired this guy because of the influx of tech companies, and they're concerned about a whole range of issues, including the culture of the people who come into the state, the intensity with which lawmakers in Texas, even conservatives, might look at this newfound wealth from tech companies and say, hey, we could spend that. So stay tuned right here, right now. David, I'm going to say goodbye to you, but we're going to have Sarah roll the tape on my interview with Zach Whiting. David, thanks so much.
All righty.
With me right now is Zach Whiting of the Texas Public Policy Foundation, TPPF. That's our kind of sister organization out there in Texas. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, what a pleasure. Now, you're not a Texas native. We should establish that fact right off.
I am not a Texas native. I come from the great state of Iowa, where it is a little colder than it is here in Texas today. We have some friends visiting from Iowa. They're buried under about a foot of snow back home, and we're here for about a day in the mid-70s or so. Glad to be a Texan, and as I hope maybe we'll discuss today, I think as folks from Texas find that I'm from Iowa and maybe not from other states, they're pretty pleased about that as well.
So you're the senior fellow of tech policy at Texas Public Policy Foundation. You're in Austin, is that right? You're in the home office?
Correct.
Okay, great. So let's talk about why you and I are talking. What do you do in this role of the senior fellow of tech policy?
Yeah, so this is a new area that TPPF is engaging in. We've had staff in other areas kind of work on and opine on tech policy over the years, but they created this new position to sort of bring it under one umbrella. Under my leadership. What we'll do is try to influence good tech policy in the Texas legislature. But TPPF also does have a nationwide interest and in influence to see other states develop good tech policy. So where Texas can be the leader for conservative values, and in this case, in the area of tech policy and tech culture, we'll try to pass good policy here and then expand that out to the other states.
From your lips to God's ears. So we'll get back to what it means to have good public policy at the state level. After we get to the real reason I wanted to talk to you, which is that Texas is, I think, harvesting a bumper crop of technology companies exiting California, among other places. And I wonder if you can tell me about the blessings and the curses of this. The most recent, the most proximate example I can think of is Apple, or rather Meta. I'm sorry, the parent company of Meta. I'm sorry, Meta is the parent company of Facebook, has just announced they're moving their headquarters, or at least a significant part of their headquarters operation, to Austin. Is that correct?
Yeah, from my understanding, they're taking up a lease on half of the newest skyscraper. I think it's at 6th and Lavaca. So that's just actually a couple blocks down the road from we are going to be the tallest building in Austin. And they've taken up a lease on the entire commercial portion. And then the other half of it will be residential. And I think that's exactly right. There's pros and there's cons with it. The pro, it's very good for the state. You have more people moving to the state, filling needed jobs. Tax revenue comes into the state. It's spending that keeps afloat existing businesses and stuff like that. But then I think some of the other things, as I'm learning, it does put a strain on infrastructure. We always joke in Iowa, there's two seasons, winter and road construction season. I think here in Texas, it's road construction season year round. So it does put a strain on the infrastructure. Housing costs are going up. I came from a very rural area of Iowa to live in one of the fastest growing metro areas in the country. So we own, but our mortgage has gone up a little bit, and you see that. The most acute concern, I think, that people see here is when you have an influx of people from out of state and largely urban areas, it sort of raises these questions about the impact on the culture and politics of Iowa. The politics of Iowa, I wish we had people moving in there, the politics and the culture of Texas. And so Texas is the fastest growing state. And for about the last 20 years or so, with one exception, most of the people moving in from out of state have come from California. But certainly with 2020 and the pandemic, we've seen them come from other urban centers, including Chicago, New York, and suburban Washington, D.C. And so I think that as folks move in from out of the state, people in Texas want to make sure that the values, the history, and the culture of the state aren't diluted by the values and behaviors that are sort of at odds or antithetical to Texas values. And so at TPPF, we have an initiative called Keep Texas Texan. We sort of look at those things to make sure that the history and the values and the culture of Texas remain vibrant and strong. And then just as we talked about it from the outset, I've sensed a visible relief, but I've heard audible sighs of relief when I go someplace and people say, "Oh, you came from out of state. Where'd you come from?" And I say Iowa, and you just hear sort of whoof, you know, that maybe I'm not going to be importing some of those values that people here hold near and dear. So yeah, it's a blessing. It's a blessing and a curse. But I hope that we can, in a good way, capitalize on this and have it be good for the state.
So
for the state's economy.
So in terms of your job, do you actually interact with tech people who move into the state? Do you talk to them about what they'd like to see at the state level? Do you talk to them about the problem of culture, history, values?
Yes, I do, and we do. I talk to a lot of people. I talk to people in politics, in the legislature, in state government, sort of on the regulatory side of things. But I am particularly interested in talking with people in the tech space, and that's in leadership and folks that are just the everyday workers. We actually have a really interesting man that has moved his company from the West Coast to Austin, Texas. His name is Peter Rex, and I'll actually be interviewing him this week at our upcoming policy orientation, which is our largest event of the year. His vision is not to just have Silicon Valley move to Texas and sort of have Texas become the new Silicon Valley. It's to have Texas become the new epicenter of a new tech. And sort of part of his ideas, which I think are fascinating and I wholeheartedly endorse, it's how do you sort of on the input side, the creators, the people that create, invent, and innovate in the sphere, how do you make sure that those values go into the tech that you create? If it's largely anti-faith, anti-conservative, family values folks that are leading these companies out in Silicon Valley, that inputs into the tech. And we see this great division of how tech is being used in a negative way and where fights and censorship and all this stuff. Peter wants to see people that have good Judeo-Christian values creating the space. So he wants to bring in the talent and the capital to create a new tech space completely that respects privacy rights and the rights of free speech and all of those things, and have that built into the cake of the technology. So it's people like Peter and across the entire tech space that I want to engage with to make sure that, as a matter of public policy, we're unleashing the ability of these entrepreneurs and these innovators to come into the state and grow and expand into these new innovative areas of technology, blockchain, artificial intelligence, and the like, to make sure that the policy, that the public policy and the regulatory space doesn't hinder that. So there's that side of it, but it really, I think, does go to, we need industry itself to change. And that comes about by ensuring that the people that enter this space have the right values and views of the role of technology in our lives. So I'm excited about engaging with folks in the industry as well.
Well, our loss is your gain. How do you, or at least mostly your gain, as we've discussed, but how do you keep legislators from doing what comes naturally to them, whether they are conservative or liberal? They begin to look at an industry like this as a piggy bank. Now, out here in California, the way that looks is that our tax revenue is highly cyclical and related directly to the business activity of these Silicon Valley firms. Well known, I think, among our listeners, at least, that about 150,000 Californians pay over 50% of all personal income tax, just as an example. So when our governor comes out and misrepresents the budget and says, oh, we've got a $45 billion surplus, besides all the mathematical tricks he's pulling to make that kind of a claim, what he's also relying on is Silicon Valley just throwing off these massive, massive profits. How do you keep, do you suppose, Texas lawmakers from looking at that piggy bank and not saying, you know what, we're going to just start expanding our spending because we now have this new influx of free money that we can do all kinds of great things with? And then my own sense is out here, right and left, but particularly left because of where I live, they find all kinds of real bad bad ways in which to spend this cash, really damaging ways in which to spend this new income. What do you say to the lawmakers at your policy gathering coming up? I think you said later this week, or maybe it was next. How do you talk to the lawmakers about this?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. So I actually have a really, I would say, interesting or unique perspective on this, because actually before I came to TPPF, I was a state senator in Iowa. And we, of course, were in charge of developing our state budget. And I think a lot of it is, it's what kind of individuals do you have in elected office, and what are their values on things like, you know, taxing and spending and stuff like that. So I was very fortunate in the state of Iowa to have 32 colleagues. There were 32 Republicans in our Senate majority who were absolutely committed to not raising spending where we didn't need to. We had a 99% limit on spending authority as compared to revenues, and we tried to come in the Senate usually closer to 95%. The House was a little bit higher. And so I think a lot of it is a function of the people that you have in government. And then I think as you approach the budget, you do have to take a look at what are these core fundamental roles of government. What should government do? And from there, figure out how you raise the revenue to accomplish those goals, and then fund government and reassess. But I think the premise of your question is exactly right. We just don't do that as a general rule in government at most levels. And so it is a very appealing thing. Even in Iowa, we were giving gigantic property tax abatements and the like to get Google and Apple to come and build their data centers, all this whole schema of tax credits and the like that the economic development community really likes, but policymakers like me find troubling. And so I know that in Texas they're trying to work to sort of, you know, end that schema. In Iowa, we're working to do that. And I speak to Iowa just from my experience to sort of end the scheme of all these great tax credits to incentivize people and just work to lower the rate. We had the highest corporate tax rate in the nation in Iowa, and the governor has proposed a 4%, and Senate Republicans are looking to go to zero. So yes, it is sort of the default position of government to say, well, how can we cash in on that? And so I think it does go to ensuring that the people that Texans elect have a respect for the wallets of taxpayers, and have an understanding that it's not their money, it's the taxpayers' money. And I think when you have people that approach it like that, rather than what can we just use this money for this pet project, I think you're in a good place. And my sense is, in Texas, they're mostly in a good place. But I think it was John Adams that said, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. And so we always need to make sure that we hold our lawmakers accountable for that.
Love it. So among the others, I won't say poached, because we drove them out of here. Elon Musk is now out there. We've got significant major tech investors who've announced that they are personally leaving. You know, even if they don't have a company as such with thousands of employees, they've got a small team that helps them reckon tech futures. They're moving to Texas. You work at the level primarily of state policy, and in thinking about state policy, you said you're interested in like kind of creating models, I guess model legislation or model policy that could be implemented elsewhere. Unlikely to happen here in California, because we just don't work that way. Our legislature comprises people you wouldn't trust to buy you a pair of pants, never mind, you know, run a warehouse or the trucking industry or, my gosh, tech or investment. What policies can you see? And let's start with the ideal that you're really only interested in kind of not recreate. You're not interested in transplanting Silicon Valley and its values. You're interested in kind of creating a new ecosystem of, you know, a philosophical ecosystem, I'll say, or a values ecosystem. Starting with the idea that information wants to be free, and we were all, you know, sort of marketed out here in America. We were marketed on the idea that tech was going to bind us all naturally together, create a huge global community in which we are all going to love and respect diversity. And in fact, it's just become one more kind of battleground. How do you, in an environment where a lot of tech people say, hey, look, information just wants to be free, let's see what this machine can do, how do you set up policy so that it is informed by values Texans share?
Yeah, so the ideal would be to, of course, have industry and the culture pivot. I think we are seeing a little bit of a shift within the cultural attitudes towards, you know, for example, big tech and social media companies. People are, you know, I mean, I remember in the early days of social media, when I was in high school and college, my network was limited to the people that shared my @school.edu address. And now you can literally connect with anyone. And as you said, there's great promise and potential to that. I've been able to connect with kids I went to first grade with and stuff like that, which is neat. But there's all, you know, there's these concerns about privacy and predation and stuff like that on young kids. So if there was a shift in industry or culture, that would be great. I think we're seeing a little bit of that, but we do also have another tool, and that is through the law and through public policy. And so at the state level, at TPPF, I think we're going to focus on a few things. I think first and foremost, and this will be one of the topics that we discuss in one of my panels at Policy Orientation, is protecting the free speech rights of citizens. We had this great debate, over censorship and deplatforming and those kinds of things. You may have thought or spoken about things, you know, Section 230 and antitrust. Those are federal issues, and then we can have those debates. But at the state level, I think that we can try to empower not only Texas but the other states to fight back and find ways to protect the rights, the free speech rights of their citizens. Texas passed a bill, HB 20, that tried to do that by shining more sunlight on the way that these companies promote posts or pull down posts or deplatform people and the like. That's Florida did as well. Those bills are being challenged. Those laws are being challenged in the courts. PPF has signed to an amicus brief in support of the state's position on that. So anything that the states can do within the framework of Section 230 to protect free speech rights online, I think is critically important. We took a stab at it in Iowa, but didn't get over the finish line. The other piece I think that's critically important is data privacy and ownership. And essentially the model for a lot of these companies is based on use our services for free. And this is great. You know, we've got, you know, free email and free social media and all these things. Well, nothing is free. And I actually have an economist that sits in the other room that if he heard me say the word free would probably break down the door and wonder why I'm using that word. But in any event, our data is being monetized, aggregated, collected, and sold for purposes of advertising. And it's things like what we search for on the internet, the keystrokes we make. Very troubling things that I'm reading in the tech space is that this type of data collection with the new technologies that are forthcoming is going to become even more granular. Things like eye movement, your gait, your sleeping patterns, all of these things are going to be collected, bundled up, and sold. And so maybe you're not sleeping well, you'll get an advertisement for sleeping pills or a new mattress. That's interesting, but troubling at the same time. And I think certainly when it's targeted at young people at an impressionable age, and you know, the left is so interesting on issues of age. We say, well, we should they're never old enough to go to war. They're way too young to be charged with crime because, you know, their brains haven't developed, but they should be able to vote and have abortions and, you know, take drugs and do all these things. But the reality is that, you know, social media use and some of these products use is damaging to young people, and their own internal data suggests that. And so things like a digital bill of rights, I think, is something that we'll want to look at in Texas to give people more control over their data. And then just one other, you know, two or three pieces I'd add in here is where can the state lead on developing an artificial intelligence code of ethics? That's has a technology with great promise, but also fraught with great concerns. I don't think we're, you know, quite at the stage of, you know, Skynet and Terminator and the Matrix and all these type of things. But we do want to make sure that, and this kind of goes back to that the values and the input in artificial intelligence do serve humanity and not harm humanity.
Let me just interrupt for a sec here. How does that not quickly become the sort of conservative variant of the progressive impulse to manage technology in deep inside a company? You know, because there's the simple libertarian argument, which is, you know, let the buyer beware, let these companies do whatever the heck they want. And if people don't like it, if they don't like the terms and conditions that go on for, you know, tens of thousands of words and basically indenture us at some level to these companies, how is this not just a progressive variant of the same, I'm sorry, a conservative variant of the progressive impulse to regulate?
Yeah, so I think that's exactly where we're at on the right now. There is this schism about how do we operate. It's the idea, there's the wing that says, let the free market reign, let the buyer beware, and if you don't like it, don't use it. For example, personally, I've gotten off of social media. It just makes me too upset or anxious to use it, so I've gotten off of it. And should I, for example, legislate that no one can use it ever or whatever? I think that's a little troubling trend. I think where we're at, and this is where this is where the sort of conservative in me, you know, does sort of take this moral and ethical view of this is the technology is being used in a manipulative manner to, you know, lock people in, to essentially addict them to use the products, and then the continued use of that is being monetized. And so I think we do have this sort of interesting question where we ask ourselves, do the rights of, you know, businesses and corporations to do what they do and operate in the free market, does it come in conflict, or does it need to be subordinated to the privacy rights of individuals and stuff like that? I don't know. I think that's part of the debate that we're having. And that's why we do need to tread, as you suggest, with the question very carefully on this. And that's the great part about the public policy process is individual legislators can have ideas, or think tanks can have ideas, or constituents can have ideas. And as we work through the policy making process and hear all of those various perspectives, because you're going to hear great pushback from these, you know, companies, for example, I think that's how you craft wise and smart policy. And so I am definitely in favor of having those debates, and just getting those things out in the open. And I think by virtue of that, that's a piece of the educational tool that, you know, parents and individuals can use to determine, do we want to keep using this type of technology, or do we want to see a shift in it? And then those changes in consumer attitudes, I really think are going to cause a shift. And we're maybe even seeing that with, you know, Facebook has changed their name to Meta. Maybe they're shifting away from social media and towards the metaverse because they see that as an opportunity. And maybe that's where consumer taste is going. And so we have to use the power of the state and regulation very carefully, but recognize that in this tech space, it's very fraught with the potential for abuse and manipulation of people for the sake of monetary gain.
That could sound very quickly like a progressive argument, you know, the problem of monetary gain based on exploitation of the consumer, that sort of thing. Are you comfortable having that conversation with newcomers to Texas who are, you know, departing the Bay Area or Southern California, wherever they come from in California? Are you comfortable having this conversation with them about the real values that you hope they will bring? Because you're not in a position to insist, but you are in a position to influence. Is that okay? Could economic development people in Austin or in Texas more broadly feel comfortable bringing Zach Whiting onto a Zoom call with somebody from the Silicon Valley who's contemplating a move to Texas?
I would sure hope so. And I'd like to think that that's a function of, you know, my personality and openness and willingness to have those conversations. Ultimately, the goal of all of this is ultimately to try to craft good, you know, good public policy for the state. And so having the perspective of TPPF and other groups that maybe have a more libertarian view on some of these things, folks in economic development, and critically, the folks that are in technology policy in that space, I think we do need to have those conversations. I'm always willing to have those conversations, and I actually anticipate having. I do have a couple meetings on the books here at our upcoming event with folks that do work in the tech space. And I view my first couple months on the job very much as a listening session to learn and listen. So I'm hopeful we'll have the chance to do that.
Man, I could talk to you all day, especially about Section 230 and my own idiosyncratic view of that mess. But that's all the time we have today. So you can always find this podcast on the National Review website. It'd be easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you subscribe. That boosts our profile. Email your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes, including Zach. Can I ask maybe if you'll send me one or two of your favorite links to policy proposals from TPPF? We can include those in the show.
Sure. We'd be happy to do that.
Wonderful. On behalf of my new friend, Zach, and my co-host, Dave Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La revolución continúa la semana próxima. Adios.